You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. So welcome to episode 287, and in this one, I chat with Saliha Hansby. Saliha shares her story, her earliest memory of OCD, violent intrusive thoughts. We talk about religious-themed OCD, seeking reassurance, checking, confessing, getting multiple incorrect diagnoses, having suicidal thoughts. We talk about medication, and then later on we talk about experiencing suicidal-themed OCD, getting hospitalized, eventually getting the right diagnosis, starting exposure and response prevention therapy, going to the ISDF conference, meeting others with OCD, relapsing, how her father now uses her experience to educate others in the Muslim community who are suffering, why she shares her story, words of hope, and much more. Wide-reaching conversation, as always. I really enjoyed chatting to Saliha. So I think you'll enjoy this one. And thanks always to NoCD for supporting the show. I deeply appreciate it. If you want to find out more about NoCD and their therapy services, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. So thanks to those guys, and thank you to you as always for listening. I really appreciate it. And without further ado, here is Saliha.
Welcome to the show, Saliha.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, it's really good to have you on. As you know, it'd be great to hear your OCD story or otherwise.
So as I mentioned earlier, just a little bit about my background before I get into the OCD story. My family and I are originally from Gujarat, India, and my family is Muslim, so we practice the religion of Islam. We come from a practicing family. My father is, and I want to mention about my father only because, this is going to sort of come into play later on in terms of my OCD. Mm-hmm. He is a religious scholar. So, what you would call like in the Arabic term, it's called a sheikh. But like if you were to, I guess, somehow replicate that, something like a minister or a priest or a rabbi, something similar to that. So I come from, my father is a sheikh. My maternal grandfather was also a sheikh. And then we come from a line of, you know, like either people who've memorized the Quran or who have, which is our holy book. So just, I wanted to put that into perspective just for when, like I said, when I go into the story, but, so that's a little bit about my family. And then in terms of, I relocated to the US, with my family when I was 7 years old. I've been living in the US since then. Now, getting to the OCD aspect. So I had a pretty, normal childhood, you know, came from a loving family, nothing, you know, like traumatic or anything like that. I was in a motorcycle accident when I was, I think, what is it, 6 years old, I think it was. And, that was probably the only traumatic thing that I experienced. But even that, I mean, it was bad in the sense that I had, kind of gotten hurt my forehead. But I, at the time, because I was 6 years old, it didn't really affect me as much, in terms of like emotionally or mentally or anything like that. And then, like I said, even when I came to the US, up until the age of 10, everything was pretty much normal. What I do remember is when I was 10 years old, I remember standing against the line at recess. And the first time I had an intrusive thought was basically about, I was standing against the wall, getting in line for to get into the classroom. And I had a thought about the thought that came to my mind was, what if I kill my mom? And I remember at that moment, it was kind of like deer in headlights, because I was just like, whoa, that was not, you know, I just froze, paralyzed. And I was not like sure what to do with this. I remember going home that night and praying to God and saying, like, you know, please don't let me have this thought ever again. And then after that was probably the first time I ever experienced a paralyzing thought or intrusive thought. And then after that, it was fine. Then I remember, like, at the age of 14 or maybe 15, I was talking to my best friend, and I guess around that time I was having thoughts about, like, what would it be like to kill somebody? And I remember sitting with my friend and I asked her, I was like, hey, have you ever had a thought about hurting somebody? And she just blatantly, she's like, no. And that was a bit of a blow at that time too, because I was just like, oh, wait, she just said no. So that must mean that what I am thinking is probably not a good thing. Like, at the time I was just thinking, like, this is not good. Like, I know that I shouldn't be thinking this. If she's not thinking this, and I shouldn't be thinking this. But none of the, you know, the first time that I had my intrusive thought, and then even this time, like, I didn't really have any actual anxiety. I had fear, but there was no, like, actual, like, physical sensations that came with it. And then when I was 19, I think, or 18, I remember the thoughts I had were about cursing God. Just, you know, I had thoughts of cursing God in my head. And at that time too, like, I remember, like, this is not good. Like, this is not right. I don't, this is not, like, I knew that I didn't want these thoughts. But I was also too afraid to tell anybody, because, and even my parents, because I was like, you know, especially coming from a religious family, and my father being in the community, kind of like a figurehead, I didn't want, it was for me, like, scary, like, to even just utter it to my father seemed like something that was, you know, how dare I do something like that? You know, it was just too scary. So I had those thoughts, but again, there was no, like, I remember fear, but I don't remember, and not wanting the thoughts, but no actual, like, physical sensations. Then in 2001, which is at that time I was 20, I went to England, and it was in February. And I don't know if, so at the time, I don't know if this is still the same, but at the time, a lot of the people, like, in their chimneys, they had these, like, I would say, like, a radiator type of heaters, where they have, like, those two orange bars, like, that glow, like, dark orange or red. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, it's like those toaster, like, when it in the toaster. Where
the fireplace should be.
Yeah, the fireplace. Yeah.
It's a very old school thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember visiting, because we have a lot of family back there. And I remember visiting quite a few homes, and, you know, it was February, so it was obviously cold. And the first time that I had, like, the first time I saw those, I just, the thought that came to me was like, oh my God, like, what if I was in the middle of that, like, bar, like that orange bar, you know? And then I thought, man, that's what being in the middle of that is probably what it feels like to be in hell. And I remember, like, going to people's houses, and that I every time I would see it, that was the thought that would come to me. And we were there for about a month, and I remember, like, you know, towards the end, I didn't even want to look at them, because it was like, every time I looked at it, that was the thought that came to my mind. And then, you know, I came back from England, and you know, things were fine. I kind of, you know, forgot about all of that. And then in July of that same year, the first actual intrusive thought where, you know, the depression and anxiety and panic attack and the physical sensations, you know, all of that came together was in July of 2001. And the thoughts at that time were, you know, I need to know, I don't want to go to hell. So I need to know that I am definitely in the right religion, because every religion out there, you know, has some kind of like a punishment if you don't die in that religion. And so the thought was like, I need to be able to make sure that I'm definitely in the right religion, because I don't want to, you know, end up going to hell. And for some reason, the one religion that sort of kept sticking in my mind was like, you know, I have to know and for sure that, you know, I have to know everything there is to know about Christianity, and I have to know everything there is to know about Islam. And I have to, and it was almost like at that time, I was like so in so much desperation that I was not even, I was completely like, out of my mind, like in terms of where do I go? Like, how do I even rectify this? You know, like this is something. And I remember thinking like, well, I could ask my dad, but again, like, what would he think that, you know, as a sheikh, you know, and then as a, you know, figure, the leader figure in the community, like to know that his daughter is having doubts about religion, you know? And I remember thinking like, and I remember feeling shameful because of that, because it was like, you know, of all the, you know, and I know this sounds wrong, but like in my head, it was like, well, of all the people that could have a thought like this, like, it's so wrong for me to have this thought because of my background in terms of like my father being the, you know, imam in the community. And then also, or imam is like what you would call like the
priest or pastor.
Yeah, exactly. And so I started looking at books that compared Islam to Christianity. And I what I really wanted at that time was just to be able to say, you know what, I want to be comfortable knowing that I am, that Islam is the right religion. Like I didn't want to change religions, if that made any sense. I was out to like just prove that, okay, whatever I read, it at the end of the day, I need to be able to ascertain to myself that I am in the right religion. You know what I mean? At the time, it was just like whatever I could find to help me. So there were a lot of books that I read at that time. But what ended up happening is no matter what book I read, none of it calmed my fears. None of it calmed my intrusive thoughts. And again, the intrusive thoughts were always about, I need to know that I'm in the right religion, because if I'm not, then I'm going to go to hell. And so I have to research whatever is out there and, you know, finally come to that conclusion that, yes, I am definitely safe. You know what I mean? And nothing that I read would give me that, that confidence, you know? And that lasted for about 3 weeks. And you know, I'm like, my personality is very outgoing, very bubbly, very, just if I'm in the room, oftentimes, like my presence, unfortunately, is known sometimes just because I'm so loud and so like, you know, active in the conversations and things like that. And so in the 3 weeks that these intrusive thoughts were happening, like my demeanor completely changed. Like I stopped talking. You know, people could tell that something was bothering me. Like my family especially could tell that something was bothering me. But again, I was so afraid to tell them what was wrong, because again, it was the same thing, like that shame of, you know, being the daughter of a sheikh, how could I have these thoughts, you know? And it, the idea that if my father knew that I was having these kinds of thoughts, that, you know, A, he would be so upset because, like, in my mind, I'm thinking, like, he will be upset. You know, I didn't really know, but in my mind, I thought he'll be so upset thinking, like, you know, what kind of a daughter is she that she is having these kinds? She's my daughter and she's having these thoughts. You know, that's that, the worst case catastrophic scenarios of my dad's reaction came into my mind. And, but like, I think the fourth week of in this whole thing, I got to a point where I just couldn't hold it back and I was constantly crying. And so I finally just told my dad. I was like, you know, I'm having these kinds of thoughts and I feel like, you know, I'm doubting my religion and I don't know what to do. You know, and I honestly, like, my thought was, as soon as I tell this to my dad, he's gonna just burst into anger or something like that, because I was so afraid of telling him. But when I told him, his reaction was, oh, well, that's normal. Like, everybody has, you know, thoughts of, like, whether they're in the right religion or not. And he's like, that's a normal thing. Like, you're not doing something that is out of the ordinary, you know? And so I just, hearing that and knowing that his reply was so, like, you know, just so gentle about it, I was like, what? I mean, it just, for a second, it didn't make sense, because I wasn't expecting his reaction to be so calm. And I also was not expecting that answer as well. And I think when I heard both of those things, and I remember asking him like two or three times to really just reassure myself that he understood exactly what I was telling him and I understood exactly what he was telling me. So somehow, like, after that, all of a sudden, I just, you know, the thoughts disappeared. And I think I had gotten the reassurance of my life at that moment. Yeah. So I went back to living normal life. And then in 2003, same thing, same thoughts about fear of going to hellfire, because I might be in the right, wrong religion. Need to know I'm definitely in the right religion. Same thing the first time, like the intrusive thoughts. And I remember at that time also going to my primary care physician, like a general practitioner, and crying. And I went there specifically to be able to seek some help because I was in such a mental anguish, but I was so afraid of telling them that, you know, I'm having these thoughts, because A, I was like, well, you know, they're probably not going to understand my fear of being in the wrong religion. You know what I mean? Like, how would a doctor be able to help rectify that problem? And then also the other thing is, I thought, man, if they sort of know that I'm constantly crying and I'm not really, like, you know, just in my head, like, thinking like a normal person, because I was like depressed and down. And so for some reason I thought they might want to, you know, consider putting me in a mental institution because I'm not acting normal, if that makes any sense. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't that I wasn't acting. It was mostly my fear is if they knew that I was so depressed. In my mind at that time, I thought, well, if you're depressed, because I really did not have too much knowledge of even depression or, you know, what a person who is depressed looks like. You know, I never, you know, nobody ever said like, oh, hey, this is, you know, I'm depressed or anything. So in my mind, I thought, oh, well, if you are depressed and if you have depression, then you must, they go to the mental hospital. Yeah. Like, it just, that was just my A plus B equals C kind of, you know, you have depression and you behave this way, then you are in the mental institution. So I was so afraid of telling them. I was crying in front of them, but I was like, oh, you know, I'm fine. I don't normally do this. It's just, you know, I'm just having a really rough day. And then, you know, she could tell that I was upset. So she was like, okay, you know what? I'm gonna prescribe antidepressant. And I remember taking the antidepressant from the pharmacy, and then bringing it home, and it just sat on my dresser table, you know. Mm-hmm. And not only was there, like, you know, all this unclarity in terms of, you know, what should I do in terms of my intrusive thoughts, but then it was also like, there's so much taboo and stigma around antidepressants and medications, psychological medications, that I was too afraid. So it just sat on my dresser table. And again, like, for about, I would say, 2.5 weeks or something, I had these intrusive thoughts. And it was towards the end of the 2 weeks, I think, is when I went to see the primary care. And, you know, into the third week, I was still just depressed. The intrusive thoughts were still there, crying every minute that I was alone. And then I finally just got to the point where I was just like, I have to tell my dad. I have to tell my dad that I'm having these thoughts again. And, you know, he needs to know. For some reason, I felt like he needed to know that, again, I was having these thoughts. So I told him again. And the same thing, he gave me the same reassurance, like, it's normal. Like, this is fine. Like, everybody has all kinds of thoughts. Like, you know, you're not thinking anything out of the ordinary. You'll be fine. And surprisingly, again, that was enough. I needed that reassurance from my dad. And I went on with my life. And then in 2006, and by the way, I was in college this whole time too. So it was interesting that I was, you know, in school and somehow was able to manage going to classes, doing my assignments, interacting with people at school. But on the inside, I was suffering, you know. And then in 2006, the same thing happened. Same thoughts came back. And this time I told my dad pretty quickly, I think, like, maybe just in 2 weeks of the whole, you know, the intrusive thoughts bombarding me, I told him, like, I'm having these thoughts and I don't know what to do. And I, again, assumed that if he gave me the reassurance that things were going to be fine and I can go back to living my life. And that wasn't the case. Even after talking to him, the intrusive thoughts stayed. And in fact, you know, I felt like I was getting worse by the day, because my anxiety was through the roof. I was, you know, constantly, like, I remember, like, needing to ask him, like, reassurance. Like, if there was a intrusive thought that came into my mind, like, I needed to ask him, like, hey, is it okay that I have this thought about religion? Like, is this okay? Like, am I still, did I come out of Islam? Like, the religion, like, is, you know, and yet at the same time, surprisingly, still afraid of, while on the one hand, I was kind of like, I need to make sure that I don't do anything to come out of Islam. I also had the fear of, well, I still need to make sure that I'm still in the right religion, if that makes any sense. Yeah. So I still wanted to make sure that I wasn't doing anything to come out of Islam, but I also wasn't completely sure that Islam was the definite religion. Mm. And, so it was constantly, I was asking these thoughts, and towards, I guess it was a month and a half of dealing with this, I started, about a month into it, I started having suicidal thoughts, because I was just like, I can't do this. I cannot continue. I was not eating. I was, you know, losing weight. I was not able to really function. You know, I literally just got up. I was still, I was towards the end of my graduate school at the time. So I literally just would go to school, function somehow to make it through the end of the day, and then come home. And I was just a cry. I would just cry. I was just a crying mess. And that's when I started having thoughts of, like, well, I can't continue living like this. I can't continue to have all these intrusive thoughts and to have this anxiety and to, you know, I'm not living, like, I'm not enjoying life. I'm not taking part in any of the conversations my family's having around me. I'm looking at people around me living their lives. They're laughing and they're, you know, enjoying their time, and they're worrying about mundane things. And I am here, you know, just I'm paralyzed, you know, and I'm like, I cannot continue looking at people living their lives and enjoying their lives. And I am here knowing that this is not normal and knowing that I'm suffering so much mentally, physically, in terms of the sensations. And I just felt like I can't do this. I can't keep going on. So that's when I started having like suicidal thoughts. And then I shared it with my parents, but not necessarily clearly. It was more kind of like, you know, I was like, you know, I don't want to, I didn't say directly that I'm having suicidal thoughts, but I said something like along the lines of like, I don't want to live anymore, you know, or this is not, I can't live like this, you know? And that was, and I kept saying that, and I had these intrusive thoughts, and I had the thoughts of suicide. And then, towards like the end of the second month, that's when I came to my parents. And for some reason, I felt like I needed their blessing to be able to go and see a psychiatrist, because at that point I had come to the conclusion that, there were three options. I told my parents, I said, either, you know, I need to be in a mental asylum and you take me to a mental asylum and just admit me there, or you take me to a psychiatrist, because I had come to the conclusion that by this amount of suffering that I was dealing with, if the psychiatrist could give me medication and if I could live a normal life without anxiety, without intrusive thoughts, then I'm willing to do it. I don't care what, what the taboos and stigmas out there are regarding these medications. And then, and I told my parents, like, or otherwise I'm just going to, at that point, I just said it to them. I'm like, I'm going to kill myself. So I said, you have these three options. And, as I said, I felt like I needed their blessing to be able to go and, you know, see a psychiatrist. And so they finally took me to a psychiatrist and I told her my whole story. And her response to it was, well, you have major depression and it seems like you have generalized anxiety disorder, maybe a little bit of OCD. And I'm like, okay. I mean, at that time I was like, she's the doctor. She knows what she's talking about. I know nothing about what I'm going through except that I'm suffering. And so whatever she says, I'm going to take it and I'm going to go home and I'm going to, you know, take the medication. So she prescribed the medication and I went home, started taking them. And I think the medications definitely worked, but even then, like I wasn't taking them properly because of that whole stigma behind taking antidepressants. So I would take it for a little bit and then come off and then take it again. And I feel like that was from 2006 until 2013. And I, in between 2006 and 2013, I did have bouts of episodes that did come with the same intrusive thoughts. But I think the idea was, well, I'm taking medication now. So even though I'm not taking it the way I'm supposed to be taking it, like every single day, but the fact that I am taking something helped me to get over those two or three episodes that I had in between 2006 and 2013. And then in 2013, I was pregnant with my daughter, and all of a sudden I had the same intrusive thoughts come back to my mind. And this time the intrusive thoughts were not so much focused on, although they were there too, like of the doubts about religion, but more of the fear of I should not have any kind of intrusive thoughts, because if I do, then they're going to lead me to suicidal thoughts. And that will lead me to commit suicide. So when I got pregnant with my daughter, for some reason, that fear came to my mind that I should never have those religious thoughts, because if I do, then they're going to lead, again, like I said, to suicidal thoughts, and then that's going to lead to suicide. So that actually brought on my anxiety, believe it or not. I was like, I just debilitated. I couldn't function. I was constantly, crying, and the intrusive thoughts were just piling up one on top of the other. Literally, I would get up in the morning and I was looking forward to nighttime, because it was like, okay, when nighttime hits, I can go to sleep and I can give my brain a rest. you know. And my day began with the idea of looking forward to night. I was not, and I couldn't do anything. At that time, I actually had, my son was actually, 12 months. He was 12 months. And so a year, a little bit more than a year, maybe like 15 months. And I remember like just sort of handing him over to my husband in terms of like, I can't take care of him. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not able to look after him because I can't, all I can think of in my head are the intrusive thoughts of the fear of, and also along with the fear of, not having the religious thought, the other fear that came was don't get depressed. Because if you get depressed, then depression leads to suicide, suicidal thoughts. And again, that'll lead to suicide. So that was also another thing. And I feel like that added to my anxiety, because not only was I having religious, thoughts here and, in between the fear of, suicidal thoughts, but then also the other fear was you can't get depressed. And the funny thing is, like, I was already depressed to begin with. But I'm telling myself, like, don't get depressed, because if you get depressed, then you're going to have suicidal thoughts. And it didn't make any sense. And I knew it didn't make any sense because I was already having suicidal thoughts. I was already depressed. But for some reason, I had to keep telling myself that don't get depressed. You won't have suicidal thoughts, but I was still having suicidal thoughts as well. So it didn't make any sense. I'm going on. it got to the point where I ended up having to get hospitalized. I had to spend a week in the hospital because I told my husband that I'm really like at one point I think I really did consider committing like suicide, in terms of like not really actually doing it, but like planning some steps out in my head. And I shared that with my husband. And then he's like, I think maybe we should take you to the hospital. And that when I went there, they evaluated me and they're like, maybe we need to keep you in the hospital. And I remember like when they took me to the psych ward, there was a police officer that actually accompanied me, from the emergency room to the psych ward. And I remember like freaking out because I'm like, oh my God, like this has pretty, like if I need a police officer to escort me, that means I must be like, in real danger, in terms of, this is not good. Like I might end up like seriously going to the mental asylum, because if the police officer is following me, then I must be somehow the way I'm feeling, that's a very dangerous thing. And I spent a week there and then came out and still had the same intrusive thoughts, but I felt like somehow I felt like I needed to get some kind of control over them, only because I didn't want to go back to the psych ward and I didn't want a hospital, a police officer to escort me again. And I remember anytime the intrusive thoughts would get, too much for me to handle, I would go back to my psychiatrist, and my psychiatrist would, because I started on a low dose, so it would increase my dose. By the end of my pregnancy, I was on the highest dose of the antidepressant that they had prescribed me. And then I had, I did okay, for like the first 2 weeks or something after I delivered my daughter. And then 2 weeks later, I started having intrusive thoughts again. And I went back to the psychiatrist, and this time she put me on an antipsychotic along with the antidepressant. And that sort of helped. And I kind of, was okay until 2017, 2017. From 2013 to 2017, I actually, when I was in the psych ward, the doctor at the time, the psychiatrist told me, well, you have, because he evaluated me and he's like, oh, you have bipolar two, bipolar two depression. So I said bipolar two, right? That's bipolar two depression. And he's like, so that he changed the medication. And then I remember, that was in Cincinnati. I actually moved to Florida in between that time. I went to a psychiatrist, and over there I told him my story, and he's like, oh, you actually have major depression. But he didn't actually say that I didn't have bipolar two either. He just said, oh, and you have major depression, major depressive disorder. And I was like, okay. And then 2017, I had the episodes come back. And what I do remember is in every time a psychiatrist would diagnose me, I would go back home and Google the symptoms of like a person who has bipolar two, or a person who has major depressive disorder, or a person who has generalized anxiety disorder. And I remember thinking like, well, a lot of these things fit, but some of these things actually don't fit me. You know, like especially the bipolar two, I was like, well, I don't have, you know, moments where I'm doing something that's risky, or, you know, moments where I'm extremely, I like the manic type, and then moments where I am, you know, I'm either, when I have my intrusive thoughts, I'm just constantly in a depressed, anxious mood. You know, I don't have those like back and forth type of thing. So I knew that something was not right with that diagnosis. And even with the major depressive disorder, I was like, I'm depressed, but I'm also having anxiety, you know? So I'm like, how come there's nothing that mentions or is not focusing on that as well? And the funny thing is, I never heard of the word intrusive thoughts. So whenever I would Google, mental disorders, it was always like, you know, anxiety and depression would come up. But even with anxiety, it was the way that, you know, sometimes they lay it out, it wasn't matching up to exactly what I was constantly going through. And so in 2017, when the intrusive thoughts came back, I was like, I know that something is not right. Like, I know I've gotten these diagnoses, but I know that for some I just know that these diagnoses are not completely what I am facing, what I am going through. There was a doubt. And so finally I went to Google and I put in the best psychiatric hospital in the world. And funny enough, the one that came up was Massachusetts General Hospital. And so I was like, that's it. If they are the best in the world, then they have to be able to know exactly what's wrong with me. So I made an appointment. And at the time, I actually made an appointment with a doctor who specializes in bipolar two, because that was the one that I had. Although the last psychiatrist had given me major depressive disorder, he didn't rule out bipolar two. So I felt like maybe that's a bit more direct than just major depressive disorder. So I felt like that maybe I should make an appointment with somebody who specializes in that, because surely if they specialize in that, then they'll definitely know what major depressive disorder is. Yeah. And so I met with the doctor, my husband and I went, and we sat for, I think, a good like 90 minutes, and he listened to my life story. And, you know, my husband chimed in and added to whatever I missed out on. And then, you know, he asked me all these questions, like, do you have this? And do you have this? And do you ever feel like this? And blah. And I just, I answered the questions. And then at the end of it, he's like, so what you have is basically obsessive compulsive disorder. And when he said that, I looked at my husband and I looked at each other, and we were both confused. Where I'm like, and I know the first thought that went through my mind was, oh, great. here's another mental illness that I have been labeled with, right? And I remember like sort of being annoyed. And so I remember like I'm like, okay, no, I'm done. Like I cannot have any more disorders labeled, you know. And in my mind, and so I was like, this time I have to tell him. Like, and so I remember like being a little bit annoyed, and I told him like, but I don't, because this was my understanding of OCD at the time. So I was like, but I don't wash my hands like 30 times a day. And I don't, you know, I was like, I'm not particular about cleaning. I'm not, you know, I don't have like, things don't need to be in order for me. I mean, there was some of that, but that was not like in my mind, like I'm like, for example, I when I used to go to the restroom, I wash my hands, right? But I'm like, and maybe I did wash a little bit longer than normal, but I didn't think that that was unusual. You know, I just thought, okay, I'm just being more aware and more sure. Like, and I knew that it wasn't really bothering me that I was doing that. So I remember fighting back and arguing back with him and thinking and saying like, you know, but I don't do this, I don't do that. And he was like, yeah, he's like, I know. And it was so nice because he was so calm about it too. He's like, yes, I know, I understand. But he's like, you know what, there is also something called intrusive thoughts. And he's like, you know, a lot of people incorrectly diagnose OCD as purely obsessional. And he's like, if I were to just lay it out, he's like, that's kind of what you have. But he's like, there is actually no such thing as puro. And he's like, I'm sure you'll learn that more once you go back home. But he's like, you know, basically you have OCD and you have intrusive thoughts. And he's like, because I also asked him, I was like, well, what kind of compulsions am I doing? Because I don't see myself doing any repetitive compulsions, because I thought compulsions have to be outward, you know. And he's like, no, there's something called mental compulsions. And he's like, that's what you're doing. And it was just like in that moment, I was like, I felt like I was on cloud nine. I just was, you know, and then after he said all of that, he kind of gave me an idea of, he's like, so, you know what you, so let, he's like, let me break it down. So he's like, what happens is you have an intrusive thought. And then he's like, you feel anxious. And then he's like, you tell yourself something to help you feel better about that intrusive thought. And then he's like, the anxiety goes away. Right. And I was like, yes, that's it. I was like, that's exactly. And it was mind blowing to me that he actually understood what was going on in my head, you know, rather than just labeling it and just saying, oh, you have this, and then sending me home. And so after that, the first thing I did when we left his office was I went to, my husband's like, all right, now that you have a proper diagnosis, let's go out and celebrate and get dessert. And I mean, I did feel like celebrating because, I was like, yes. And at this point I hadn't even looked up like the symptoms of OCD, but I just somehow in my heart this time I knew that this is it. This is the diagnosis. And I remember going to the dessert place and sitting down and first thing was I pulled up Google and looked at symptoms of OCD. And oh my goodness, I felt like, whoa, a huge amount of pain and confusion had just lifted off of my shoulder. Mm. I felt like for the first time in the world, in my life, I knew, not only did I know what was wrong with me, but I knew that now that I know what's wrong with me, I can actually get the right help. I remember thinking that. And so then I, around that time, actually, we had moved to Dallas. And so I came back to Dallas and I found a therapist who specializes in OCD. And, you know, I started seeing the therapist. And it was just mind blowing. I mean, initially starting ERP was hard, but I remember telling my therapist, like, I don't want to do ERP on suicidal thoughts because I don't want to commit suicide, you know? And you know, she was very supportive and she's like, no, you can do this. You have the ability to do the ERP. And she's like, I'm here with you and we're going to do this. And, I it was almost like, you know, putting one foot in the water kind of thing, like testing it out to see like, is this going to work? And I think just that initially was what I needed to sort of kind of gain that confidence. And then I started doing proper ERP. And around this time, actually, my therapist also introduced me to the book, Is Fred in the Refrigerator by Shala Nicely. And I remember reading her story and I was blown away because I was like, whoa, these are exactly the kind of thoughts that I have, you know, and this is exactly how I think. And just her sharing her story and how she overcame it, I was like, okay, I can do this. Her story was so motivational for me that I, within 2 months of starting therapies, when my therapist recommended this book, and that book alone, I think if I was at like, you know, 40% in my recovery, I think reading her book probably got me to like 60 or 80, I would say. And then in her book, she mentions the OCD conference. And surprisingly, it was in June that I was reading the book. And she, you know, in the book, she mentions that the conference takes place in July. And automatically, I went to the website and registered. And I was like, I got to go to this conference, you know. And then after that, I also, she mentions in the conference, like, or in the book, that she attended Dr. Wilson's intensive. And so I was like, okay, I got to do that too. And I remember like calling the secretary for Dr. Wilson and thinking, you know, he's this amazing psychiatrist. There's no way that this late in the game, I'm going to even have a chance to, get a spot in his intensive program. But luckily there was. And I attended that. And funny enough, actually, something that also happened to me around the time that I first started therapy with my therapist was they had a support group that they had started. And it was the first time in my life that I had met other people who had OCD and who had intrusive thoughts like me. And that alone felt surreal because in my mind, I also still had this fear that I must be this, you know, not so normal person. And, you know, if you're out there living in the world, then you don't have a mental illness. You know, you can't, in my mind, I'm thinking if you have a mental illness, then you're not really out there. Like you're not living a life where you're married and you have kids and you have a job. And because my understanding of it was just so, what's the word to use? Like so misunderstood. I started the therapy, believe it or not, a year into it, I was actually able to get off of medication, actually 6 months into therapy. And then for 6 months after that, I was really good too. So for a whole year, I'd say about like 12 months or, I'm sorry, 14 months or so, I was really good. And then I sort of just assumed that now I have everything in my belt in terms of like, all the tools that I will need if I ever have anxiety again. I will never need to worry about it. I'll never need to worry about another intrusive thought because if I do, I'll know exactly what to do. And so that misunderstanding sort of led me to sort of not really focus on doing ERP so much because the idea was, well, I know what to do the next time I have intrusive thoughts, so I can relax a bit. And about 14 months or so into my recovery, I relapsed. Really badly, terribly badly, if that makes any sense. I just, and it was funny because I thought, like, I tried using the tools that I had, and I was not able to use my tools according to the way that I thought that they would work, you know? And I lost a lot of, believe it or not, something that I think not a lot of times is talked about, but I feel like is probably out there, is that when a person first starts ERP, I feel like they have a lot of confidence in it. But when they relapse and then they have to do ERP again, I think that there's a lot of, what's the word? There's a lot of hesitation and a lot of trust in ERP, because you're like, well, I'm, you know, and you think you're using the tools, but you're not, unfortunately, but you think you are. And so that results in, you know, you actually, you know, having a lot of distrust in ERP and thinking that it's not going to work again. And that's for a year. I suffered with that I was doing ERP, but in the back of my mind, I also had this feeling like, well, I don't think ERP is going to work for me again. Because if I relapse and I'm using the tools, which I thought I was using, and I'm still not getting better, then that just means that I am not, you know, ERP is not going to work a second time. And so basically I for a year I was just, you know, having intrusive thoughts, and mostly these were the intrusive thoughts revolved around suicidal ideation. And actually this past December is when somehow the light bulb clicked, because something that I realized is that when I was doing ERP post relapse, what I thought was ERP was just me doing passive exposures. I was doing passive exposures. And what I mean by that is that when an intrusive thought would come into my mind, I would, you know, try my best to sit with the anxiety, and I would, you know, not do the compulsions in terms of not talking back to my intrusive thoughts and things like that. But I was not doing active ERP. I was not actually going out and seeking, you know, things to stir my anxiety up. And that was something that I realized actually last December, that, oh, that's that, the light bulb sort of went on, and I realized, like, that's where I'm going wrong with this. And so since then, I still have, I think something that is, I'm learning to accept right now, is that even once you have sort of ERP down, it's not like you're never going to have bad days. And I think something that I'm also, because I'm deathly afraid of relapses, or was after it happened. And so something that I'm coming to terms with and learning to accept is that, yes, as scary as it sounds, a relapse is possible in the future. And coming to terms with that and learning to accept it. And like I said, even to this day, you know, I am doing a lot better post relapse since December, but there are still days where, you know, intrusive thoughts get the better of me, and, you know, the anxiety's there and things like that too. But something that I have to remind myself is that, first of all, you know, recovery is something that I hear all the time, is recovery is not linear. You know, there is going to be good days, and there are going to be good days, and there are going to be bad days. And so that's kind of where I'm at. I know that was a long story. I don't know if I said too much, and I apologize if I did, and you can edit out whatever you want to edit out. I just felt like I didn't know if I should say the whole part of it, because if I didn't, it wouldn't make sense. I don't know. So
no, it was good.
I hope what I said was not too.
I'm not gonna reassure you. Right. I liked it. Yeah, one question. No, thank you so much for sharing your story. And it's quite a journey you've been on, you know, since the early 2000s. So, you know, you mentioned your dad early on, and he featured throughout. when you got that diagnosis and you felt that the correct diagnosis and you felt the relief from it, yeah. I'm sure most of the listeners can relate to that feeling of you know that's it, that's what I'm experiencing. When did you tell your dad about it, and how did he react?
So you're talking about like, when did I tell my dad that I have OCD?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it was immediate. Like as soon as, cause my family had known that I had flown to, my husband and I had flown to Boston. They were aware of that. And so, and they knew that I had an appointment with the psychiatrist and stuff. So immediately after I came out of the appointment, I told my parents right away that, so guess what, guys, I have OCD. And my family's like, okay, but why are you excited? And it was like, you know, so I had to tell them like, no, like this doctor knew exactly what was happening, like what's wrong with me. And I think this is the correct diagnosis. And so when I told my dad, he immediately he was just like, I'm so glad that, you know, you finally have the diagnosis, the correct diagnosis. But I think initially also for my dad, when in 2006, I think the first two times when I had my episodes in 2001 and 2003, they didn't really, I think, come to the conclusion that, okay, maybe our daughter has some kind of a mental illness. I think they were still, and especially from the Indian subcontinent, and I think a lot of, you know, just a lot of cultures, there's a lot of taboo, you know, there's a lot of most cultures, you know, there's a lot of taboo and a lot of stigma attached to mental illnesses. And so I think for them, it was really difficult to, even in 2006, when I finally did go to the psychiatrist, it was still difficult for them to sort of accept that, you know, our daughter has a mental illness. Because I think for them, it was like, oh, this is just, you know, this is something that she's just going through and she's going to snap out of it and it's going to be fine. And I think a lot of having a hard time accepting that came from the culture, you know? And I also think that the other thing is that, I mean, as a scholar, he didn't have a lot of understanding of mental illnesses, just like I did. So for him initially, something that he would often tell me is like, well, you know, you can read, you know, certain parts of the Quran, which is our religious book, or certain prayers. And he's like, you know, these are things that you can do to kind of help you alleviate your anxiety. And again, that was, part of his understanding was, well, maybe this is a religious thing. Maybe this, you know, again, it was that there, it's not a mental illness. Maybe this is just a religious, you know, thing that she needs to work on doing, you know, reading more Quran and things like that. And maybe that will help her. You know, so he also definitely told me to do that. And I think now, actually, believe it or not, because as the imam in the community, he's been called many times when people do end up having, you know, family members have, you know, some kind of like a mental issues. Unfortunately, in our community, a lot of times it gets misunderstood as, oh, they've been possessed, or, you know, it's some kind of jinn issue, you know. And so a lot of times, unfortunately, in the Muslim community, that there, a lot of mental illnesses are understood as, oh, it's that, or there's they've had some kind of evil eye put on them or something like that. And so initially, when my dad used to go for these calls, you know, to go and talk to a person, or to, he would just go and he would pray, and he would tell that person to, you know, say these prayers, and just kind of tell the family member that it's okay, you know, they'll be fine and things like that. But once I found out that I have OCD, and I started, you know, doing more research on OCD and just learning more about mental illnesses in general after that, and getting more understanding just in general mental illnesses. I started educating him and I about the different types of mental illnesses that are out there. And then I think he also saw my own recovery. And so now when he actually gets called to go and visit somebody, he'll tell them you should do these prayers and things like that. But he will also first and foremost, he'll be like, listen, this is not jinn. They're not possessed. He's like, yes, these things, because there is an understanding that these things can happen, but the understanding is that those are really rare. Right. And the idea that, I hope I didn't trigger anybody by that, but the understanding is a lot of the issues that are going on in terms of mental well-being are psychological, and they need to be treated by going to a psychiatrist or a therapist, a psychologist, taking medication. So now whenever he goes to see, individuals, first and foremost, he tells the family members, like, listen, they need to go and be seen by a psychiatrist, take them to a therapist, get them evaluated. I can give them these prayers, but at the end of the day, the reality is, there is a mental illness that is happening here. And he's like, they need to be, seen by a professional, medical professional. So that has been really great in terms of my dad's own journey in understanding Absolutely. Mental illness and being an advocate and helping out in the community too for mental illnesses.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful to hear how he's seen your journey and changed in his own way to help others, which is awesome. Just to clarify, jinn is genie, right? Is that
so we say jinn, but similar okay. understanding. Not genie as in like
Aladdin.
Not that, but something kind of like a supernatural type of being.
So you you mentioned Is Fred in the Refrigerator, the book you mentioned, and obviously going to the conference, taking Reed's pre-conference course thing, going to see professionals and getting help, medication. Was there anything else you either did historically or you currently do that just helps generally with mental well-being?
Yes. Something that I have done. So up until basically, I would say 2015, I was very, quiet. My family also didn't want to share with others that our daughter has a mental illness, again, because of the stigma, the misunderstanding, the taboos that go with, that wording. There weren't a lot of people that knew that I was suffering with intrusive thoughts and with mental illness, or that I was suffering. Cause I at that time, those that I did share it with, which were my immediate family knew. And then, a few of the mentors in the community that I live in, the Muslim community, who I felt like, maybe they could, because they were around my age, that maybe they could kind of help me with dealing with the, intrusive thoughts, and depression. So I would actually tell people that I have depression, or those that I did share it with. What happened is in 2015, I got to a point where I was just like, I can't be secretive about this. I suffer from this a lot, and I am not, I'm tired. I'm tired of not being able to be honest about what I'm going through in terms of like, people know me, but I feel like people don't know me either. Like there's this other side of me that I have and I struggle with, and I'm tired of making it seem like I have everything together when I do have this big thing in my life that I struggle with. And so I started like telling my story to my friends and just, people that were close to me, outside of my mentors and my immediate family, obviously. And then, and just sharing my story. And at that time I would just tell people that, I have depression. Sometimes I'd say I have major depressive disorder, once I got diagnosed with that. And then, But since my diagnosis of OCD, now I think what has helped me the most, aside from, you know, Shala's book and Dr. Wilson's intensive and other things, is just being more vocal and just being, I feel like I look at myself as an advocate, especially in the Muslim community, because again, well, even in the Muslim community, like, I feel like there's a lot more awareness and acceptance of the fact that mental illness does exist and that this is something that we need to address. And, you know, we need to tell people that there is help out there for it. And so I feel like the best way for me to help the Muslim community and just anybody in general who is suffering from a mental illness, Muslim or not, is to be open about my own OCD and my own struggle. And that has also, being an advocate has actually helped me with my own journey, because I feel like by me sharing that I have this illness, the idea that if I can help somebody not suffer as long as I did because of my outspokenness, then their decrease in suffering is my way of saying, you know what, I'm doing something positive about this thing that I'm going through. So yeah, that's it. That's another thing that I've been doing, is being more vocal about it. And yeah, now I'm to the point where, you know, even in the community, certain, you know, if an occasion arises and, you know, there are people talking, I look at it more now as not just, oh, me telling my story, but as a way of saying, hey, because I feel like OCD is probably one of the ones that are so misunderstood, you know, just like my misunderstanding when I first got diagnosed, you know, I automatically assumed it's about hand washing and cleanliness and all of that. So, and unfortunately that stigma is still, that misunderstanding is still there. So I really like to be able to say, hey, you know what? OCD also looks like this too.
Yeah. Yeah. Really good point. I like that. So next question that comes to mind is just words of hope for anyone listening. And I guess it'd be good to answer this generally. Mm-hmm. And then specifically for anyone, any sort of Muslims out there who are afraid of owning it or speaking up, or, you know?
Yeah. I think generally speaking, for those who are suffering with OCD, something to keep in mind is being able to come to a point. I think something that I have learned is, there are a few things that I've started sort of learn on my journey, if you don't mind me sharing those. One is that it's so important, like when you do have these intrusive thoughts, to be able to sort of come to the understanding of what your core fear is. Because when you understand what your core fear is, then from that, you will be better able to understand your intrusive thoughts and be able to sort of better do your ERP. So that's something that in my own journey I've come to learn, is that knowing, and I know for me, like my core fear now that I've realized is suffering. So that knowing what my core fear is, now I can better understand my intrusive thoughts. And also I can now better, I can enhance my ERP because of that. Another thing that I have also learned is, you know, the whole active versus passive ERP. I feel like that's so important, because a lot of times we, you know, if you're just doing passive ERP, because for me, what happened is when I was doing passive ERP, eventually I got to a point where I was avoiding things. And I was like, this is not, I knew that was wrong. Cause I was like, wait, why am I doing ERP? But yet I'm getting to the point where I'm starting to build walls. You know, I'm starting to avoid situations. And for some reason that confused, even though I had learned so much about OCD and about ERP when I first started therapy, for some reason, it didn't click the second time around. It took me a year to figure that out. Actually a little bit longer than a year. So just that the active ERP, right? Looking, going out there and actually looking for things that stir your anxiety, I feel like is so important, because that's where you're doing the real work. That's where you're really challenging your OCD and saying, like, you know what, I'm willing to, you know, take on these intrusive thoughts and these feelings and sensations. And I think something else is, for a lot of people, they think that, and this is from me just share, like attending support groups and things like that, this idea that once you start therapy, that you are just, you know, there's a certain number of days or sessions that you have to attend, and then you're done and you can move on, you know, with your life. And for some individuals, that is the case. Like, I know for myself, like when I first started therapy, you know, I did it, my sessions with my therapist. And at a certain point I felt like I got enough, like I can now manage this on my own. But something that I have realized is, you need to constantly be doing ERP, even when you think that you've got it. And also another thing is also like seeing, I feel like for me personally, what has helped me is to continue to see a therapist. Because even though you can get to a point where it seems like you have it under control, I think just when you are still working on your ERP, to still have a therapist there to guide you, I feel like is so important. Something else I was going to say, but I completely lost my my train of thought. But yeah, that's another thing that I learned. And also another thing is just that, this is what I was going to say, is that you can't, like, a lot of times people expect that the journey is just going to be, you start therapy and then you get to a point where you don't have to go see a therapist anymore. But I feel like the reality is that the journey is not always linear, as I said. So once you have your therapy under control, you can still have, or your anxiety and OCD under control, you can still have days where, you know, intrusive thoughts will plague you. And you will still have days that are, you know, bad days. Right. And that's something that for a long time, I did not want to accept. I felt like, you know, now that I know what OCD is, and now that I know how to handle it, I'm never going to have bad days again. And I'm never going to have to struggle with OCD again. And the reality is that with this mental illness, you can get to a point where you can start to live life, but don't, you know, the expectation that, you know, you're going to have good days and bad days even so.
Yeah, really good point.
Yeah.
And yeah, the second part of the question, sorry.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot it. I'm not sure if I even answered the question.
No, you absolutely did, the first one. The second one was just, yes, and any Muslims listening that were a similar position to what you were, just anything you'd say to them?
Yeah, I think that for especially the Muslim community, I think something to keep in mind is that mental illnesses amongst Muslims does exist. And the idea that, well, if you have a strong faith, and if you read the Quran, and if you have a connection with God, then, you know, you shouldn't have depression or mental illness. That is a complete misunderstanding, you know, because I think even with, I feel like my own story highlights that, where, you know, I come from a religious family. I come from a family where, you know, I have taken my faith very seriously. And yet, and that was something that actually caused me to struggle for a long time, is because there was that misunderstanding on my end that, well, you know, I am a practicing Muslim. So therefore, the fact that I have a mental illness, or therefore that I'm struggling with, you know, these kinds of thoughts, like, that's not acceptable. That means that there must be something wrong with my faith, you know? And so to realize, and also again, like coming to that realization and accepting the fact that, you know, there is no, OCD doesn't have the thing, well, if you come from a religious family, then you're not going to have a mental illness, or you're not going to have OCD or whatever. You know, the fact is that it doesn't matter what kind of family you come from, mental illnesses can exist with any individual, no matter their background. And to come to the acceptance that, you know, taking medication for mental illnesses is not a bad thing. That, you know, this taboo and the stigmas that are surrounding it, that, you know, if you take it, that means you're weak, or if you take it, then, you know, we don't want to tell people that you're taking this medicine, because then somehow we and the individual are going to be looked down upon. What I can say is that when you take medication, it will help you so much that at the end of the day, it's like the stigmas and all of that can be out there. But if I can take medication and I can live my life and I can be, I'm able to enjoy my life, then I feel like that's much more worth it than what anybody out there is going to think about an individual taking medication, because your life and what you, you know, you being on this earth and, you know, what you want to experience and the things that you want to do, those things matter, you know, and to worry about what other people are going to think, and letting that be the guide, to your decisions, and that in the end causing you to continue to suffer, that's not fair on the individual who's suffering. So I feel like it's so important that there is medication, there is help out there, medical help out there, medical professional help out there. And knowing that, and then, you know, just saying that we, you know, either the individual or the family thinks that, you know, it will look, you know, bad on us, or somehow, you know, we will be deemed weaker. I feel like that's, you're just doing a disservice to the individual and to yourself as well, because the family at the end of the day also struggles when the individual struggles, especially if you come from a nuclear family like I did, where my parents, you know, seeing me suffering, it wasn't just me that was suffering. I mean, it was hard on my parents too, you know, to be able to see me crying and to see me asking constantly for reassurances and things like that. So for the Muslim community, I think definitely we need to get over the idea that, you know, mental illnesses are, you know, not something that exists in the Muslim community. They very well do exist. And the fact is that to accept that there is help out there and to get that help, because every individual deserves that, and every individual deserves to live in peace and enjoy their life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, really good words. Yeah, and I've heard it in many other communities too, so it's definitely not like just in the community, you know.
Yeah, and something to point out too is that's not to say that like, you know, we do, like in our religion, we do have this idea that you should read the Quran, that you should there are these prayers that you can do, which we call dhikr, that can, you know, help you to build your faith, right? And it's okay to use those as a tool along with the other tools that you're going to use, like medication and therapy and all of that, to use those along with that. Definitely, there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, as a Muslim, I would advocate that that's just as important as taking medication. You know, to know that along with those things, along with seeking help, praying to God, asking God for help, it's just as important to treat mental illness as a physical illness, rather than just saying, well, you know what, just snap out of it, or, you know, you can get better if you stop thinking about these things, which I was also, by the way, told too, is you can, you know, just stop thinking and it'll be gone.
Yeah, really, really good points. And yeah, the way I look at it, and obviously it depends how each individual looks at religion, but if God created all things and the earth, he created therapists too, you know. So seeing a therapist is a godly thing,
Yeah. And actually, in our religion, there is a saying that, you know, for every disease, there is a cure except for death. that is a saying of the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, that, you know, for every illness, for every disease out there, there is a cure. And so definitely. And I think understanding that cures can come in the form of medications and talking to individuals. Yeah. Is important to accept that these are also forms of treatment.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you for sharing. So you've got a bit different question. You've got a billboard where you live. What do you want written on that billboard?
You know what? There are two things, and personally for me, that have helped me to get through even the toughest times when I wasn't diagnosed. And they actually, interestingly enough, come back to my religion. And, I think I would definitely have these phrases on the billboard, because it can apply to everybody. And the first one is basically that with every hardship, there is also ease. And so the idea is that, yes, you have this, you know, mental illness that you are going through, but at the same time, there are also things in your life that we can, that are probably going well too. There are probably things in your life that are still, that God is still taking care of, and granting you those things that are going well in your life as, you know. And so, that's, I think, something that and what that does is it helps you to sort of be grateful for the things when you are suffering, that to really truly be grateful for what you do have, even in the moments when you are suffering. So, and when I say gratefulness, something I've come to understand with gratefulness is not just to be saying, oh, I'm grateful for the water I drink, but to really like contemplate, what about water is it that you are grateful for? You know, is it the way that it feels on your tongue? Is it the way that it feels when it goes down your throat? Is it the fact that it's so cold? You know, is it the way it looks? Is it the way it feels? You know, to really be grateful, to really contemplate. Like, for example, if I say I'm grateful for the color yellow, that's great, but why is the color yellow something that's special to you? Why are you because it reminds me of the sun, and I love the sunshine, and I love sunny days, you know. Or so that, what I mean is, like, when you say I'm grateful for something, it's good, obviously, to say what you're, you know, on the surface, what you're grateful for, but to really break it down to what does it mean when you're grateful for this thing, you know? And I think when you really dig deep, it really helps you to really get into the mood of being grateful. You know, like, you're not just saying it at the tip of your tongue, but once you start really delving into that gratefulness, you actually start like, oh my God, like, this is actually really fun. Like, I'm loving how I'm delving into why I'm so grateful for this. So definitely that is something that I would put on the billboard, is that, you know, with every hardship, there is also ease. And also the other understanding of that is also, you're going through a hardship right now, but that doesn't mean that your life is always going to be in this situation, that after this, there will still come a time where, you know, things will be better and you'll have happier days. So that's the first thing. So the other thing that is also that I would like to put on the billboard is that whatever hardship or difficulty that you are going through, just for me, this has been helpful, is knowing that, you know, that difficulty is something that God knows that you can handle it. That's why you have been given it. So yes, it may at times feel like, oh my God, this is so hard, living with OCD and, you know, doing ERP. But knowing that whatever difficulty that you are going through in your life, God knows that that is something that you are capable of handling. And so that is why you have been given that test. So I guess the billboard would say something like, you know, with whatever difficulty you have been given, know that you are capable of going through it and handling that difficulty.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I like that. And then lastly, is there anything else you wish you could have shared today?
I think that's pretty much it. I hope that listening to my story coming from the, you know, from a Muslim background, I hope that this helps, you know, if there's any Muslim out there that is listening, to know that, you know, you're not alone. And also, and something that I've learned actually is that when I started being more vocal about my OCD, a lot of quite a few individuals have actually come forward to me and said, hey, I'm struggling with this illness or mental illness or this or that. And so, you know, to be able to point them in the direction and say, hey, you know what, you can go here and get help. That has also been something that I'm also grateful for. And I know like two of the cases, I was just like, baffled because I was like, wait a second, I think I can diagnose you, even though I'm not a therapist, but just listening to all the things you say, I think you have OCD. And so, you know, obviously I encouraged them to go see a therapist, and I even helped them find therapists using the International OCD Foundations, because they were, I was very sure that they had OCD. And so, so I helped them find therapists, and they, you know, they've been very grateful for that. So that has made me feel grateful to be able to say, hey, you know what, my, sharing my story, I'm glad that it was, if I hadn't spoken up, then they could very well still be suffering. Yeah. So the willingness to come forward, that's not to say, I mean, I completely understand. Not everybody wants to share their mental illness. I mean, depending on where you're at in your journey, it might still be something that's very personal to you. And that's not, you know, so if you feel like, if an individual feels like, you know what, I'm not there right now, I'm at a point where I just need to focus on my recovery, and just those individuals that know and they're there to help me and guide me, that's great too. That's not to say that you have to be an advocate. And I do feel like once you really do get on that recovery journey, something that automatically comes is that desire to want to help and to want to be, to want to say like, hey, you know what, I know that there's other individuals out there that are suffering. And if I could do something to end that, I mean, I feel like it just comes almost automatically once you get to a certain stage in your recovery.
Yeah. Good point. Well, a great way to end. And thank you so much for sharing your story and your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it too.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. And if you want to find out more about NoCD, visit go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.